Welcome to Thinking Ahead. I'm your host, Carter Phipps, and we're exploring the movements, trends, people, and ideas that are shaping our evolving world. Make sure you subscribe today on your favorite podcast platform, and most of all, I hope you enjoy today's episode. In our modern world, we often think of history as being mostly driven by international politics and economics and technology and demographics and the movement of money. And much of that is true much of the time. But every so often, events transpire that make us remember that there are other forces, deeper undercurrents that also drive history and which can be quite powerful. I'm talking about undercurrents like religious passions, spiritual yearning, deep nationalism, and the search for cultural identity. If you take a longer view of history, these have arguably been even more powerful. The recent Russian invasion of Ukraine has been a stark opportunity to learn that lesson again. It sent 1,000 journalists looking to understand the reasons behind what we're seeing on the screen of our TVs and other devices. So where do we find those answers? Well, some at least may be found in unconventional areas, places where most contemporary scholars are not accustomed to looking. In his recent book, The Return of Holy Russia, author and scholar Gary Lachman points out that many of Putin's favorite philosophers and thinkers were products of an era of Russian intellectual thought, sometimes called the Silver Age. It was a highly creative era in the late 19th and early 20th century, a mini renaissance of new thinkers writing before the Russian Revolution, a time in which new progressive spiritualism and occultism of European thought mingled with the more ancient orthodox mystical and religious currents, and even some new science in mix. Many Russian thinkers of that era imagined a cultural and spiritual destiny for Russia as an alternative to the more overt materialism and increasing atheism of much of Europe and the West. And as with many traditional theologies and even some progressive movements of the time, there was an eschatological or apocalyptic aspect to a lot of the thinking of that era. This notion that Russia had an almost messianic role to play in the world, combined with many of the traditional apocalyptic strains in Russian thought, is certainly concerning as we consider how it might be influencing events in Europe today. But to know how to respond to those, it is important to do our best to understand. That's why I'm pleased to be able to bring Gary Lachman on the podcast to discuss his book. Lachman himself is something of an anomaly in the world of historians. He's an expert in the history of esoteric thought, especially those currents that were arising in Europe and America in the 19th and early 20th centuries, that era that was defined by movements like theosophy and spiritualism and new forms of psychology and all kinds of new thinking. And his biographies of some of the more colorful and even notorious characters of that era are fascinating. He has books on Jung, Ouspensky, Madame Blavatsky, Rudolf Steiner, and even Aleister Crowley. I got to know him a number of years ago in the early 2000s after I read his book, A Secret History of Consciousness. But I hadn't talked to him in almost a decade until I picked up his book on Russia and realized he might have some important insights into events on the ground in Ukraine today. Incidentally, it's worth noting that Lachman wasn't always a scholar. He is also in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the one-time bass player in his early 20s for the iconic band Blondie. Let's welcome Gary Lachman to Thinking Ahead. All right. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah, great to have you on again. As we were just talking before I hit record, you know, we had some, in the 2000s, we had quite a bit of contact. We met and you wrote some articles for What is Enlightenment. So it's nice to reconnect after all this time.
Indeed,
and
yes.
And I've, you know, I kind of followed your work here and there and have some of your books, and you're so productive. Just as a writer, I'm always impressed by your productivity. Just your pure productivity is very impressive. So as you said, you write like a book a year. But you have become you are a great modern contemporary scholar of esoteric history, and you of course, have come to a lot of people's mind, I think, recently, because one of your recent books was somewhat prophetic. You write about prophets, and you have become one, almost, we might say, with the book The Return of Holy Russia, Apocalyptic History, Mystical Awakening, and the Struggle for the Soul of the World, which points out a lot of things about the situation intellectually and culturally in Russia today that many of us and many people are just now waking up to because of what's happened in Ukraine. So I'd love to talk about that some, but maybe before we even get into the contemporary situation, just to kind of delve into what, you know, some of the aspects of the book itself, which was written a few years ago, and, you know, what inspired you to write this book? What was the core thesis of it before we get into the contemporary situation?
Yes. I wrote the book. As I was saying before you hit the record button, an earlier book called Dark Star Rising, Magic and Power in the Age of Trump, which is about the sort of occult politics that seemed to be happening around Trump and his fellow travelers in his campaign and during his administration. And in that book, I also looked at stuff that was happening in Russia, because the alt-right people that were, you know, promoting Trump, they had connections with people in Europe and people in Russia. And one fellow in particular, which I'll get into later, who is in the news, actually, these days. And so I had this material left over from that book. And then I came across an article about Putin. And I think it was 2014 or 2015. He, at a meeting of the annual conference of United Russia, sort of the major political party there, he right. gave his regional governors a reading list. And on the reading list were these philosophers from a period known in Russian history as the Silver Age. And this is roughly about 1890 to about the Bolshevik Revolution around there. So. And I thought it was interesting, because I was familiar with at least two of the philosophers. And when you say philosophers, they're not like Western academic philosophers. They're almost like visionary or mystical or very spiritual. Nikolai Berdyaev is one of them, and the other right. is Vladimir Soloviev. And there was a third fellow about whom I wasn't familiar, and he's a much more political thinker, a fellow named Ivan Ilyin.
Right.
And he's in the news as well these days. But the response that I saw from Western critics, David Brooks, I think it was the New York Times, he was saying, oh, these sort of mystical Russian thinkers, they have this notion of Russian exceptionalism, although, you know, they didn't use that term. That's a contemporary term. But this notion, there was a sense that just before the Bolshevik Revolution, there was a kind of religious or spiritual mystical awakening, and this notion that some kind of new cultural current was going to come out. And Russia already had, in the 19th century, acquired this name of sort of Holy Russia.
Yes.
And this goes back in the whole history of Russia from the very, very beginning. And again, it ties into what's happening today in Ukraine, in Kyiv, because it was indeed in Ukraine, in Kherson, that Prince Vladimir, Slav, ruler of the people known as the Rus, then converted to Orthodox Christianity, and then later right. he converted the rest of his people. So that's when the Russian people, the Rus, became, they were known as the God-bearing people, and they completely absorbed and just embraced Orthodox Christianity completely, and it was there, and they were very moved by it. And the thing that convinced the early Russians to convert was apparently the beauty of Constantinople. Queen Olga, who I think it was, she was Vladimir's grandmother. She went to Constantinople, and she was just overwhelmed by the beauty of Hagia Sophia and the incense and the chanting and the candles and all of that. And this was a vision of the world to come. This was a vision of heaven. And this was all brought back. And then they reproduced that to some extent in Kyiv itself. So this is like a whole kind of religious background to a kind of sensibility Just the point I want to make
Sure.
It's cynically or not. I mean, I'm when I say this, because the reason I want to make this point is I've done a few interviews already, and some people seem to think I am personally saying that Putin is holy and this cause is a holy cause. I'm not saying that at all. What I am saying is that if you do your homework and you look at the history, you can see that there was this whole character, a kind of religious character to the sense of Russian history.
I was not I didn't know one way or the other. I reading your book was, you know, it was quite a deep dive into Russian history, just an fascinating sort of, picture of Russian history, much of which I didn't really know, especially that era. And I didn't know that this is my ignorance, right? I guess, but I didn't know that you know, Moscow was considered in Russia the third Rome after the fall of Constantinople, things like that. Yeah, and that there was this kind of history of Orthodox, almost eschatology and as you say, apocalyptic thinking, but also this kind of messianic sense of Russia's role in the world as this carrier of this mystical truth out of from Rome to Constantinople to Russia, which was really interesting. Of course, I didn't even know that Tsar is a sort of it sort of stands for Caesar. You know, that's where it comes from. Of course, it makes total sense, but that's fascinating. Yeah.
Well, in Germany, you had the Kaiser, so that came from Caesar.
Right.
I mean, and they're all, again, that's another part of Russian history, some factual, some mythic of links going back to the Roman Empire. If you know this, the double headed eagle symbol that you see in the background, there's pictures of Putin and that's a symbol. I'm definitely going to avoid saying icon, because there's actually real icons in the history. I mean, we use this, I don't know if it's in the States as much, but here everyone uses the word iconic to mean great or famous or popular or well-known. But actually, you know, an icon is this religious painting of a saint or a scene. It goes back to Egyptian sarcophagus painting, the roots of it.
Oh, is that where it was?
Yeah, goes back like to Alexandria, so the Greco-Egyptian. And the different sphinxes and the sarcophaguses are different and all that, but that's where it comes from. And it's this particular, paint that they use, particular mixture of ingredients to get this kind of glistening effect. But the whole idea was this, the icons were sort of previews of what the world to come is like. And they're sort of known as windows on heaven, windows on the next world. And they have a whole history in there. But see, so this whole background, the third Rome, this was the thing. Moscow after, again, Kyiv, there was this period known as the Kievan Rus. And this was a kind of golden age of early Russia. So this is like the 10th century to about the 13th. It didn't last too long, only a couple of centuries, and then the Mongols invaded Batu Khan and the hordes of horsemen, and they just decimated it and everything else in their path.
Right.
And so the Russian people were under what is known as the Mongol yoke for a few centuries. And then that fell apart. The Mongols, they all dissipated at a certain point. And then
you capture the struggle between the Mongols and, to some extent, the Western rulers at the time and the Catholic Church and the influence of the West and the influence of the East sort of caught between.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the other thing, too, is, and again, you said, part of my ignorance. I was very ignorant, completely ignorant. I didn't know about Russian history pretty much until I wrote the book. I mean, the period I knew was the Silver Age, because I was familiar with some of the writers and the artists.
Yes.
And it's Uspensky, who I've written a book about, Peter Uspensky.
A great book. Just let me stop there. It's a great your book on Uspensky was marvelous. It's worth reading if people are interested in that era.
Oh, thank you so much. But he himself comes out of that period, this Silver Age period. He was a writer and a journalist. And again, this is a time where a lot of interest in mysticism and the occult and the esoteric theosophy. And Rudolf Steiner, oddly enough, was very, very influential in the 1900s in Russia. And he gave a series of lectures. They originally were supposed to be in Russia in 1905, but the aborted 1905 revolution, you know, canceled that. And in 1906, there was a big kind of theosophical jamboree in Paris, in France, and he wound up giving a series of talks there. And quite a few of Russian intelligentsia who fled after the failure of the revolution came to these talks. And Steiner himself had this vision of this new cultural epoch, the beginning of the, you know, the new cultural epoch. You know, he talks about different kind of, it's a version of evolution of consciousness, you know. And it's like, I think it's the sixth post-Atlantean, you know, after the sinking of Atlantis. It gets crazy, but
Steiner having strange esoteric system. Well, Steiner is this beautiful mix of extraordinary and strange.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Well, again, well, he starts out as a sort of Goethe scholar, then all round sort of German intellectual, and then he in his 40s he sort of comes out of the spiritualist closet and starts giving lectures to the Theosophical Society, and then it becomes, you know, huge. It becomes enormously popular. But he has this vision of this new cultural epoch coming out of the Russian people, and they are the God-bearing people. And the way he describes them, it all, you know, it all sounds like a very good kind of thing. And then other people like Hermann Hesse, he wrote about, you know, we called Russian man. And Russian man was this strange mixture of, you know, antinomian clashing ideas and values. So someone like Rasputin, the holy devil, you know, able to hold together all these contradictions. And it's a threat to the West, because the West is, you know, logical and everything is sequential and it's either or. And you know, and Hesse saying the novels of Dostoevsky, there's these characters who have this kind of vision of this, what he calls this kind of terrifying sanctity of everything. So they're able to embrace everything. And so, and others as well, people like Edgar Cayce, you know, a bit later on, you know, so there's all this kind of vision of something supposed to be coming out of Russia. And, you know, it's in the Russian kind of cultural history itself. And all that was kind of canceled during the Bolshevik, you know, time.
Right.
And when
right.
you think about Russia, again, when the book came out, when I did interviews then, practically everybody, the only thing they knew about Russia was the Bolsheviks, the commies, the Soviets and all that. So right. the whole idea that there was this other, you know, earlier pre that, and it did have this religious kind of character.
And Orthodox Christianity had, I mean, we forget sometimes, but I always think you have, like, you know, in the scale of sort of the mystical elements of religion, you go from Protestantism, which has very few of those elements, has a lot of other great qualities, but has very few of those elements, to Catholicism, which has more, to Orthodox, which is a lot more. It's almost closer to those ancient traditions in a way, even more mystical in a lot of ways. And why a lot of people went back to the Orthodox traditions, even Catholics in the 60s and 70s, when they were looking for more mystical practices, they went back to Orthodoxy. You know, they went back to the Desert Fathers. They went back to the, you know, to those monks who were the God-bearing monks of yesteryear. And they went back to the, you know, to those original, those texts to find the mysticism and the meditations of those eras, because they were sort of closer to the source. Closer to, you know, they were more prominent in the, that tradition. Yeah. We sometimes forget that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things is, how should we say it, in the Orthodox tradition, there's a very strong monastic tradition. I mean, obviously there is in the West as well, but this actually, it kind of made Russia, as it were, because the country expanded by the monks going out into, it wasn't the desert then, it was the forest, but making a little clearing, you know, just to get away from everything. And then other ones turn up, and then there's a little community, you know, then suddenly it's too crowded, and the other monks leave again, and they keep going, you know, up and up, or wherever it is, because it's the endless plain. That's the other thing about Russia.
That's how the country grows. I love that.
Endless, but it's so, you think about America, like, oh, it's, you know, go west, young man. Well, you could probably fit about maybe two or three Americas, I think, in Russia. Maybe I might be wrong, exaggerating it, but it's endless. And the notion of pilgrimage linked to this kind of, and one of the, somebody else who I mentioned in the book, around the same time as I was saying Steiner's lectures and Hesse's, his writing about it, is a German historian, philosopher, historian named Oswald Spengler. And he wrote this fantastic book. Most academic historians think it's, you know, just kind of crazy, but it's actually a wonderful read. It's called The Decline of the West. And he had this kind of organic vision of history rather than a you know, one linear, you know, sequence, you know, starts back in wherever, you know, Babylon, and, you know, now it's up to us now in a straight line. No, it's a series of civilizations that rise and they grow and they reach maturity, then they decline. And so there's a kind of organic sort of each separate civilization. And he said the West was on its way out. But he too said that the next, you know, one coming up, as it were, would be coming out of Russia. And he makes this point that in the West, people in the West look up. And if you think of the Gothic spires, you're talking about, you know, the Western, you know, church and all that. We think of the Gothic, you know, church towers that go pointing straight up to the sky. And this is the sense that Spengler said of sort of the Western ego, the Western singular, you know, self. Whereas the Russians, they don't look up, they look out. They look out into the vast, you know, tundra, you know, the terrain in front of them. And there's a broad difference between the West that focuses on me and in the East and Russia, the focus is on we. And again, if you look throughout Russian history, the individual is usually not considered that important. That is a Western kind of import in many ways. And again, that's another struggle that goes on throughout Russian history, is the struggle between elements in it that want, you know, to be more Western, like Peter the Great gets that going. And then talk about the Mongols, there's a whole kind of, it's very popular now, where this Mongol period is supposed to be, oh, well, this is horrible time. This is when we're in captivity, as it were. But now many historians think, no, this is a good time. We gained all these sort of, you know, virtues. We are peoples of the steppe, and we need to expand. You know, we can't be closed in, you know, in these borders. And, you know,
oh, interesting.
One that wants to say Lebensraum, but, you know, it's not quite the same thing. But there, and yeah, so there's all this notion of the particular kind of genetic background to the Mongol, the people of the steppes, is something that's inherent to, you know, the Russian people now too. So
all of these, so I was not aware of the degree to which all of this reawakening of this mysticism and occult sensibility and esotericism and all these intellectual currents and a lot of this apocalyptic and millennial thought that goes along with it, especially in the Russian character, but across all of that thought, really, and the declinism and the sense that the West is somehow this materialistic, modernistic, rapacious, you know, beast that must be resisted, and, you know, and that it's too individualistic, and you know, all that stuff that was all part of those postmodern currents of those postmodern spiritual currents of Europe in the Silver Age, what you call the Silver Age, that era, that all has reawakened and sort of engulfed Russia over the last couple decades since the fall of the Soviets. I wasn't aware that had been so prominent.
Well, I mean, one of the things that happened with the collapse of the Soviet Union, but even before, you know, with Perestroika and Glasnost, is that things that had been forbidden. I mean, there was always an underground, community reading these kinds of things, photostat copies of, you know, books or something, that thing. But once the restrictions were loosened, so much of this material was republished, and people were just, you know, they were shoveling it out the doors, as it were. And one of the things that happened with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then the further kind of chaotic conditions that occurred when they tried to import Western, you know, free market ideas and a variety of other things, was a search for an identity. Because if we're not Marxists anymore, we're not communists. We're not quite. We're not just another, you know, free market capitalist country. And again, it's not like I'm neither saying capitalism is good or bad, or I'm not trying to do that. I'm just trying to give the background, all this sort of stuff, and just the kind of context.
Well, you have a great way of one of the nice things you have as a historian is being able to get inside these kind of currents of thought without being totally sold on, without being sold on them, but to describe them and give them and get inside them in a way that where you feel like you get a sense of them without necessarily drinking the Kool-Aid.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's good to know, you know, again, yeah. Be good to know. Again, I think it is the case that some Western, you know, whatever, commentators or, you know, people involved in this are starting to realize that these kinds of things are you know, at least they're part of the rhetoric, they're part of the story. I mean, how... It's the thing, you're looking around for a sense of identity. And so Putin starts looking back to this period, the Silver Age, which is just before. And there's this incredible cultural awakening. It was an awakening of art, of music, great, you know, Stravinsky, The Rite of Spring, okay, for one thing, that fantastic ballet that introduced modern music. Well, it's about primitive pagan pre-Christian Russia. It's a pagan fertility. Right. And the background, the idea for the ballet and the background, the backdrops to the original production were came from a painter named Nicholas Roerich, who was a theosophist, but he also was an explorer, and he traveled throughout Mongolia and he traveled throughout Central Asia. And then in the 1920s, he actually tried to create a pan-Buddhist nation. In northern India and all that. And,
I remember
and he was like, you know, he was making deals with the Russians, making deals with everybody to try and do this. So say, you know, we think of this Rite of Spring as modern. It's modern music, but it's actually modern. Much of modernity, modern music was a return to these ancient kind of primitive sorts of things and an influx of theosophical occult sort of ideas. So this is just one product that came out of that time. But you have, I mean, again, Blavatsky, she was in the States and then in India.
Another Russian, right? Oh, she was Georgian, I guess, right?
Well, it all depends. Well, Ukraine.
Right.
Where she was born.
Oh, I guess Gurdjieff was Georgian, right? Or Blavatsky.
Well, it's like Armenian. I mean, it's like, it depends exactly when he was born. I mean, his national identity, but his sort of, you know, from his family, he was sort of Armenian. Or Turkish or so, that. And then, but who, what country owned where he was born at the time? That is like, depending on what date of his birth, but basically, but he, you know, he came to be known out of Russia, out of that whole period.
And
I was going to say another period of the Silver Age, when there was so much interest in spiritualism and mysticism and all that. That's where he starts to, become Gurdjieff. And that's when he purposely seeks out Uspensky. Because Uspensky is very popular then. He's giving lectures to, you know, hundreds of people, thousands of people about his journeys in search for the miraculous, you know, in the East and all that. And Gurdjieff, you know, zeroes in on him and says, we need him, because he always needed a good front man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did. He definitely did. And Blavatsky was so, you know, had a huge impact. She was another kind of Rasputin-like character, a character of great contradictions, impossible to put in one box, you know, crazy and, you know, obviously incredibly, you know, had a certain brilliance and built this huge movement as his, you know, bear of a Russian woman in the 19th century when no one was doing that. I mean, and that movement was hugely influential on esoteric and intellectual thought all over Europe and America. Just an amazing thing, but also, again, part of that era, you know.
Before
the world wars, right?
Yeah, I mean, and not only that, but politics and all that as well. I mean, again, I was going to say, one of the things that you recognize when you start looking at Russian history and these people is that they seem to produce these kind of characters that have this great kind of just spiritual gravitas, this kind of, you know, just this power. Sort of like the Starets, which were these sort of wandering priests. They didn't necessarily occupy any, you know, powerful position in the hierarchy of the church. And there isn't quite the same hierarchy in the Orthodox Church as there is in Catholicism. But just from their own personal sort of spiritual energy was so obvious and radiant that they would just, you know, have this, Rasputin's like that. Blavatsky was like that in her own kind of way. Gurdjieff had that kind of thing, but also people like Soloviev, and there's all these, you know, stories of, you know, these fantastic characters that go on these enormous pilgrimages. I mean, thousands of miles. I mean, Rasputin walked from Siberia to Jerusalem.
Wow,
that's a bit of a hike. You know, And, you know, however many months it took, but this was something that, they did, you know, it was just part of, you know, you heard the, and the West, you have figures like that, but it's not quite, they're not intense. They don't have the same. And of course this sounds like a lot of cliche. And I actually, there's a, someone I know through the internet and I've done a couple interviews with him and he is Russian. And he said, oh, every time I hear about the Russian soul, I just go, eh. You know, it's like, it just sounds like, you know, a cliche to him. But, you know, he said, yes, I know exactly what you mean. It is part of the Russian kind of history. In fact, I heard from him recently that he left where he was to get out of danger because he was in Ukraine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Wow, that's a reminder of what's happening. And yeah, but before we get into that, I mean, I know, like, I remember going to, you know, when I was a young journalist and I was trying to interview a Orthodox leader in Boston. I think he was in Boston. I think he was Russian. Maybe, I'm not sure if he was Russian, but I think he was Russian. But anyway, I remember going to Boston and spending a day in the Orthodox Church there and with all their prayers and everything, you know, and studying the way of the pilgrim and the Jesus prayer and the influence of all that, you know, on and Mount Athos. And, you know, we got, you know, at that time got kind of deep into the, reading all that. And you talk about some of that in the book. And I really brought back those days of studying that. And I remember talking to him. I remember talking to him about mysticism, and he had a certain intensity and power. And I remember at one point we were talking about God, and he looked at me and he said, you know, but God is uncreated, you know, the uncreated light, you know, that you talked about. It was very powerful. It had a certain kind of, you know, it felt like he was speaking, you know, had a certain kind of conviction and of truth in it. It was quite interesting. And then, but you know, the moment you get him talking on politics or just even talking about Catholics, I mean, he would go off and just say something horrible, you know, about, like, you get him talking about Thomas Merton or something, you know, because Catholics, you know, they were like, Catholics were, you know, not to be considered serious people, you know, like that. I mean, it was that kind of tribalism in that. So it's just kind of fascinating that the contradictions of that, you know, on one hand, that what seemed a deep, authentic religiosity, and on the other hand, this kind of political naivete, but also political tribalism, and this kind of our way is the way, and everyone else is kind of messed up and screwed up. And you see a lot of that today. You see a lot, I mean, it seems like a lot of that we're seeing today.
Well, yeah, I mean, what can you say? I mean, it's, well, how should we say it? Unfortunately, quite a few countries at different times have, you know, said, you know, God was on their side, and had sanctioned the war and all that. But I mean, again, there is, you know, in Russian history, there is. I mean, there's the. It sounds like how should we say it? A comic story now, but it was tragic. You say World War One. During World War One, I mean, the troops were so badly supplied that at one point they were Nicholas, Tsar Nicholas, was sending troops icons.
Oh my God.
Because they didn't have, you know, and I mean, so, I mean, again,
but have food.
This kind of, this notion that this was, again, this was part of it. And again, I'm not saying it justifies anything. It just gives you the backstory, as we say today, because we tend to look at everything from a secular perspective, and we tend to think, oh, okay, in terms of, you know, rational reasons for doing something. And of course, they're not missing in all this. And again, I'm not saying in any way that Putin is a mystic. Obviously, he's a very cagey strategist and tactician and politician. Well, and he has to have been to stay in power for as long as he stayed in power. So he's a ruthless power seeker and all that. But what he has done has been doing, and if you pay attention to his speeches over the past you know, several years, is he makes references to this tradition. He makes allusions to, like, the Third Rome. And I said, one of the things in the beginning of the my book, Return of Holy Russia, I point out is that in 2014, when they annexed Crimea, Putin took a stone from Kherson and brought it back to Moscow, and it became the cornerstone of the 60-foot statue to this Prince Vladimir the First, who had converted back in 989. So the current Vladimir seems to identify quite a bit with the first Vladimir. And there's a whole notion of regaining that land, you know, that's Russia. And it's not, I mean, the whole battle or struggle between Russia and Ukraine goes back centuries. It goes back a long, long way, you know. And also, you know, other places too, Poland and Ukraine, Lithuania and Ukraine. And battles between the Catholics and you said the Orthodox and all this kind of thing. So that area has been subjected to like a tug of war.
What's the relationship? Yes, it's been right. What's the relationship between Orthodox Christianity, this mystical postmodern elements and indigenous elements, which have always had a complex tension with Christian thought? And Putin's effort. How are those all sort of situated? It seems like all those are playing a role here, but they all kind of live in tension with each other. What's your reading on how all those are fitting together here?
Well, I mean, I'm saying he's made it clear that he doesn't consider Ukraine a real country. You know, he always in his speeches the written records of them, it's always in quotation marks and all that. And he himself has gone out of the way to show his own connection to the church. He made a pilgrimage to Mount Athos, I think it was 2016, and that was televised. And then he was 2017, it was the reconstruction of a monastery that had been, you know, destroyed by the Nazis. I don't want to make comparisons, but you know, we know Trump is sort of, you know, he's sort of shown his Christianness a certain way in that, you know, to get in, you know, the Christian right. So how much is Putin really, you know, embracing the church? I have no idea. Nobody really knows, as far as I can tell, what's going on inside his head. I mean, there was a funny comment by Angela Merkel. She once said after some meeting with him, and she said, "What planet is he from?" She had no idea. And again, that's the other thing too. You know, you mentioned Vladimir Vinatsky earlier before we started recording this.
So for the listener, Vinatsky was a Russian thinker in the early, I guess, early 20th century, late 19th century, who came up with the term noosphere, which then later inspired Teilhard de Chardin, who sort of made that term famous, and I wrote a lot about in my own work. So.
Yes, and and he had this idea that geobiology or something like that, where it's how life has affected the planet. You know, the presence of life on Earth has affected, so it's affected the atmosphere and that. But then you also say, on top of that is the next layer or level is the mind, the noosphere, and how that's affected. But he also believed that events on Earth were affected by forces coming from outer space, cosmic rays, or a variety of different things like that. And a variety of different thinkers at the time who subsequently came to be known as the cosmists, because they have this vision of a cosmic connection between the Earth and again, it's the kind of thing like, wow, that sounds great, isn't it? Yeah, you know, God, the Earth's a living planet, we're all part of the cosmos. Yes. But one side of it is that we as individuals simply don't matter, because, you know, what matters are the large, huge bodies of things, like the individual tree doesn't matter in the forest. So again, it's this vision of the we, and the sense that major events like the war now going on in Ukraine, or the special military operation going on in Ukraine, from Vernadsky's point of view, and also from other cosmic thinkers at the time, these things would be triggered by, you know, events happening out in space. Could be sunspots, cosmic rays, whatever, a variety of different agents were offered. And again, this is one of the strange ideas that Gurdjieff told Uspensky when they met. He said, "Oh, you know, because this is just at the beginning of World War One, and obviously on everyone's mind is, you know, did the war have to happen? Could we have stopped it?" And Gurdjieff said, "No, it was absolutely your individual efforts aren't going to do anything. It's because two planets have come too close together in their orbits, and it's created a tension in the solar system, and that drives events here on Earth." So, but that sounds like a weird occult idea. But in Russia at the time, this was something that was, you know, thought, yes, this is part, and it makes sense. You know, we're not isolated, you know, individual units, like things in a box, you know, it's all part of something that's deeply interconnected and so on and so on. So there's a lot of state, I don't want to say they, because it's, again, it's you're generalizing and all that. In Russian cultural and intellectual history, there are some ideas that for mainstream Western thinking just seem, you know, very, very crazy.
Well, I think it's fascinating to consider that a lot of these ideas that we're getting thrown out, that we're talking about, you know, we're getting tossed around in that era as part of this, in that era before the war, and then later on in the 60s, when we had this reemergence of the consciousness revolution of the 60s, which were sort of what I'm going to call kind of postmodern sort of spirituality, which were really, trying to transcend what many saw as the problems with sort of, you know, contemporary materialistic, you know, culture or the modern culture. And I can look at some of those critiques and say, okay, that's we're trying to find a deeper spiritual meaning. We're trying to go beyond just a way of looking at the world that's just, you know, atomized individual cells, that's just purely mechanistic, that's just purely, you know, that a lot of the movements to depth and spirituality of that era were all in the service of transcending that perception that the modern world had its limitations, right? We needed to go beyond those limitations. Yeah. So it's one thing to say that now, but you can also go off the rails with that, right? You can not just say it has its limitations. You can start to make the whole thing wrong, that it must be resisted. It's evil. It's a materialistic force that we have to switch from the individual to the collective. We have to switch from materialism to spiritualism. You can, to use Ken Wilber's phrase, transcend and include, or you can transcend and reject. And some of the more, When you're transcending, you're going beyond. But what happens when you break down those walls and you try to transcend, sometimes other forces take control.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, I think even, you know, not to say that Putin is Hitler or anything like that, but even a lot of Nazism itself in some ways was the resistance to Western imperialism.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's,
you know, that it was all built around that framework, but it's like, and as people pointed out, you know, you think you're going to transcend this modernist world and create the beautiful world of Hegel, but what you get is the disaster of Hitler, you know?
Well, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. That danger of thinking, you know, of being how do you change the world in positive ways without being subsumed by the dark forces of history?
I mean, I personally don't think you have to change. The world's changing all the time, you know, so we don't have to change the world. We can add to it. We can add to it. Something. But I mean, one of the things you're saying here is, I think, you know, we could bring in, character that I alluded to earlier and didn't mention, this fellow Alexander Dugin. Now he has to have the one of the strangest trajectories of anyone on the political scene these days, and he's still, you know, a more or less fringe kind of character. But he started out in the 1980s as an anti-Soviet punk dissident, and he got arrested for singing anti-Soviet songs. But then later on, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, he realized he was a real Soviet character. So he became this kind of reactionary against Yeltsin and all of that sort of thing. And over the years since then, he's gone through what I call, I've written about him in Dark Star Rising and in Throne of Holy Russia, a kind of series of ideological quick change acts where he's velcroed together a variety of different fascist, authoritarian, totalitarian, every kind of political, socioeconomic system that would be against liberalism, against the West.
Anti-liberalism, anti-West.
So that, but, and he's also a traditionalist, and you know, or from the school of René Guénon, who wrote The Reign of Quantity, polemic against Western materialism, and Julius Evola, the Italian esoteric thinker, but also far-right political philosopher, who in the 1930s and 40s cozied up to Mussolini and National Socialism, and had some success. And then later in the 50s, he was sort of the gray eminence behind quite a few new right movements in Italy and in Europe. And most recently, he was one of the intellectual kind of heavyweights for the alt-right. Again, they were very newsworthy a few years ago, but you know, whatever happened to them? You know, I don't hear anything about any of them anymore. And Evola is that he's a brilliant, many ways, very sharp, very insightful critic of the West. But he's also, his cure is worse than the disease. His cure is...
easy for the cure to be worse than the disease. Exactly.
His cure is to return to what, or create what he would call a traditionalist kind of caste-based society. That's sort of like, I mean, the thing was... People say, "Oh no, but he criticized Mussolini, and he got in hot water at Mussolini." Yes, he criticized Mussolini, but because he said Mussolini wasn't fascist enough, that was the thing. If Mussolini was making too many deals with the Catholic Church because he needed to, have the church behind him, and so on. So there's this whole anti-West, anti-material, anti-modern body of literature that, yes, it's we can say it's accurate in its diagnosis, but it what it offers
is disastrous recommendations.
I would say so again, but at the same time, there's good stuff in traditionalism. We can read it and all that, but I find it too severe for my own
exactly
case. We're
not transcending the individual in this. We're obliterating the individual.
Well, that's the thing, too. I mean, but this is something that Dugin wants to happen. I mean, his main enemy is the Western individual. He said he believes he will accept any kind of philosophy about, human society, except any kind of individualism, that kind of thing. And his ideas have... different times and at different levels have reached Putin. And one of the ideas he has is there's what's on his way to bring about the final decline of the West. And in fact, he's impatient with the decline of the West. He wants to knock it down.
He's like, come on, it needs to move along.
It's been declining for, over a century.
For at least 200 years, right? Ever since it's been rising, it's been declining.
It could be like the recline of the West, more like, kind of laying back now. But in any case, it's sort of like he wants to bring on this final, smackdown battle between these two fundamental archetypal opposing forces. And all war throughout all of history has actually been about the conflict between these two opposing forces. Then he calls one is the Atlanticists, which are the seafaring, maritime, mercantile, merchant sort of nations that, the mother of all continents, Eurasia, which is the largest landmass on the planet.
Wow.
And Eurasia is also this is the new civilization that was supposed to be rising up 100 years ago, before the Bolsheviks came to town. And that it's happening now. And this is why Russia is not, again, according to Dugin, Putin too alludes to this. And also this other thinker I mentioned earlier is Ivan Ilyin, who actually 100 years ago in 1922 was one of the people on what are known as the philosophy steamers. And these were these two boats that Lenin had put all of the intelligentsia that he couldn't just eradicate outright, but he couldn't have them stay anymore in Russia. So they were shipped out of St. Petersburg to Europe. And Ilyin, Berdyaev was on them, and lots of other fantastic Russian cultural and intellectual figures. But Ilyin had this vision of this kind of theocratic, going back to the early Ivan the Terrible sort of days of when the church and state, it was a theocracy then, You know, it was absolutely one full, you know, body with the czar, you know, leading everything. And he became a kind of white Russian emigre intellectual in first in Germany, where he actually he kind of liked the Nazis, but then he got in trouble with them because he thought their racial ideas were too crude, and then he had to leave, and he went to Switzerland. But he wrote a series of essays in the 40s and 50s. He died in 1954. But one essay is about what the dismemberment of Russia will mean, you know, to the world. And he was convinced that the Soviet Union would collapse. It took longer than he thought it would, but he was convinced it would. And he said that what would happen when it collapsed was that the West would offer, you know, free market, self-determination, independence, all of these nice things to the bodies that once were part of, you know, the Soviet Empire. Another thing to remember is this is the only time when Russia hasn't had an empire. In its whole history, it's always been an empire. Now is the only time it's been an individual nation. And what Putin wants to do is to reclaim what they call the near abroad. These were the lands that used to be part of the Soviet Union that have now, you know, got independence, like you can do that. So Putin is a great reader of Ilyin. And in fact, he had Ilyin's remains removed from Switzerland and brought back to Moscow and buried in the Donetsk monastery, famous monastery there. And so his vision of this kind of theocratic, holy kind of Russia is something that, again, cynically or not, however, is something that's informing Putin's vision of things.
You write in the book, I wrote the quote down, you say Ilyin, and I think I actually bought a book of his because I was curious to read it because I think I heard that Putin was reading him a few years ago. But you say fascism and Nazism in his mind were heroic ventures, spiritual resistance movements defending the values of tradition against the rot of Western democracy and the rise of atheistic communism, fighting against the mechanized atomized societies of the West. That really, good, right? Really well written.
Well, I'm saying
that captures that quality, yeah, what we're talking about. Yeah. That's what we're dealing with here. And it's like, I mean, I find it's a little bit worrying. It's one thing if the Russian society wants to do their own thing in within the borders of their nation, you know, create their society as they so choose. It's another thing if they see this apocalyptic confrontation with the West as part of the destiny of history.
Well, let's hope not, because that's the whole thing now, you know, right? How far? I guess one question is how far Putin think he can go, you know, pushing things before, you know, it's playing chicken. You know, how far will you go before either he uses something? I mean, let's hope that never, ever, ever, ever comes to pass. I mean, I actually, how should I say it? I scared myself earlier this evening because I was watching the news and the horrible scenes in Bucha and places like that. And I had a sudden vision of like, gee, what would happen if, you know, he did, you know, start using nuclear things. And I just had a quick, you know, very vivid thing of, you know, explosions happening just, you know, down the road from me. And I thought, oh my God, like, don't even visualize that. I mean, I don't mean to sound scary and alarmist and all that, but there is a certain, that's another element in Russian history is, and this is something that Berdyaev said himself, the Russians tend to be people of extremes. So it's either, you know, the millennium or the void.
Yes.
And there's throughout Russian history, they've had their own sort of localized apocalypses. You know, I said the Mongols invade, everything's destroyed. Ivan the Terrible comes and he's pissed off.
Quite a picture. I know the term Ivan the Terrible, but I didn't know the history. And oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, terrible actually is supposed to mean Grozny, is supposed to mean dreaded, but still, you know.
Yeah.
All these sorts of things where, and again, that's another theme, the Ivan the Terribles. The Russians are said to need a strong ruler. They're unruly. They can't rule themselves. They're not given to that. They need the little father, you know. And this is supposed to go back to the very beginning when the native Slavs invited a Danish Viking, Rurik, to basically rule over them. He said, rather than you and your brothers coming raiding us every season, why don't you stay here, rule over us, protect us? We can't rule ourselves. We're bickering all the time. You rule us. We'll listen to you. We'll treat you well. And you could fight off the other Vikings when they come. And they said yes. And so this was supposed to be the mythic beginning of the Russian nation. And the Rurik, you know, eventually over a few generations, the Viking influence, the North influence was, you know, sort of dissolved it into the Slav. And then you start to get, after a few generations, you don't have any sort of Danish sounding names anymore. Oh, they're all kind of Slavic names. But again, it was like, we can't do it ourselves. And this is supposed to be something. And it was, if you know the history, you know, it's how should we have it? It has worked very well for a tyrant or two at different times to say, well, look, I'm only doing what you people need. But there is that story of Ivan the Terrible or Ivan the Dreaded, basically, you know, getting peeved at something and leaving and wandering off and, you know, leaving the throne and all that. And instead of everyone, you know, going, wow, great. It's sort of, oh, what can we do? We can't, you know, we need our czar. And, you know, people went after him, begged him to come back. And that's, he said, yes, I'll come back, but you have to give me absolute allegiance. You must absolute, you know, obeisance to everything I say. And this is when he starts the first sort of kind of, well, sort of medieval police state, the oprichniki. And these were black hooded and black caped, sort of, you know, equivalent of sort of holy Russian Gestapo at that time. Coming. And what can you say?
Yeah, I mean, it's very, of course, we don't know how deeply, like Putin himself, we don't quite know where he stands with all this, how he feels about all of these things and how he sees his role. I guess the sad thing at this point, and Ukraine is interesting too right now, because Ukraine seems to not, I don't want to, you know, the whole, obviously the country has different currents in it. I'm not saying this is true of the whole country or universally true, but it seems to want to move a little bit more toward the West and towards some of those ideas. And I think reading your book and understanding these currents, even at an existential level, a civilization level, you see why that is a threat, not just strategically, tactically, but almost culturally, why that movement toward the West is a threat, is an almost existential threat, whether that's a legitimate threat or not. I'm not saying it's legitimate. I'm just saying you can see where the feeling that part of our body of people, whatever that means, is sort of going over to the enemy. If there's some sense of that, that's interesting. That helped clarify.
Well, I mean, you know, you understand. Yes. Well, this is the thing. This is sort of what Ilyin said. You know, the West always wants to neutralize Russia. There's what's known as Russophobia. So the West is afraid of Russia and just wants to neutralize it. And, you know, If sort of like there was 19th century before World War I, there was the Austrian-Hungary Empire, huge, you know, area. And then after World War I, there just was Austria. And it was a tiny place, longer a power in the world and all that. And it's, you know, in a way that's sort of what happened, you know, post-Soviet Union, not quite the same way, but it lost all of those lands, that there was no longer an empire. And so, so now it's kind of, so you can understand, there would be some trepidation about encroaching, you know, NATO and so on closer and closer on our territories and all that. But, you know, I guess at some point, I don't know. And who knows what's behind motivations going on in Ukraine itself. And I mean, I'm from that point of view, I'm not a political analyst or anything. I'm just watching it on the news, but I do know this history. I mean, the sort of universal Christianity that someone like Soloviev, believe that might emerge from Russia in the late 19th century, with the Tsar actually being a figure of that, an embodiment of that. In fact, he Soloviev was such an idealist that when Alexander II was assassinated, he asked the next Tsar, Alexander III, to forgive the assassins, and this would be a show of Christian mercy. and mm-hmm. love. And no, of course he didn't and all that. So I don't think we're seeing any evidence of a kind of Christian universalism emerging in the cities in Ukraine now.
Yeah, that's for sure. And it's not clear how the people of Russia, I suppose, feel about all this, but it doesn't seem like there's some, or how much they know. And Putin, and obviously I feel like it's so easy to capture the sentiment of the young cosmopolitan people in the cities. What you don't often see is how the people across that vast landscape feel about it all, and how much they know, and how they're thinking about it. And I've heard people say that Putin's base is Russian women, older Russian women, really, or that's kind of his base across the plains of Russia. I mean, across all of Siberia and all of that.
Yeah.
And that's a very different than what we see protesting in St. Petersburg.
Oh yeah, right? Sure. Well, again, Trump, I don't know if it's the same thing, but he had enormous support and still does. One wants to avoid generalizations like the Russian people. I don't know. The one Russian person that I've had any contact with lately, I said, is this fellow Nikita Petrov, who's got a website and a YouTube channel. He's actually it's worth checking out. He's saying this is, people don't really want this, but you can't, have you seen these, again, it's horrible that it happens, but these surreal pictures on the news of people just holding up a blank sheet of paper and getting arrested by the police in Russia for doing that. So it's like, sadly, ironically funny, but at the same time, it just shows what kind of total control. And one of the things I do sort of allude to in the book is this notion of the right man. And this was a kind of psychological profile that Colin Wilson, a British writer who's been very influential on my work, he wrote about. He did quite a few books about psychology of crime. He's an existential philosopher, and he's written about consciousness and the occult and all that. But he also wrote a series of books about crime. And it's a wonderful book called The Criminal History of Mankind. And The Right Man is a psychological profile of a character. Can be a right woman as well, but more often male, who under no circumstances will admit to being wrong, will ever admit to being wrong in anything, and if pressed to it, won't lose face and will, resort to violence if necessary and so on and so on. And there's quite a few, obviously, demagogues and political figures and gurus and such. They have an absolute need to have this kind of total certainty about, their rightness and all that. And so, Trump certainly seemed like that to me. And I think Putin probably has a good deal of that as well. So, and that's scary. Well, if you push to the wall, if you can't save face in some other way, you might, have to resort to some drastic measure.
I think, one of the things, especially in America, this is not just true in the West just much, more in America, I think sometimes we forget how strongly, even in our contemporary age, that history play, that deep sense of history that we don't really have as Americans in that way, and that's a blessing and a curse, I suppose. But in this respect, it may be a blessing, but that when you go to Europe, immediately you just feel that sense of rootedness to history. And there's something beautiful about that, and there's something that's dangerous about that and can be problematic about that. Like most things, it's neither good nor bad, but it has positives and negatives. But you definitely feel that here. And that's why I appreciate reading your book, is like the Russian people have this deep sense of history. Some of these things, even though obviously communism and the Soviets tried to sort of exclude some of that from the culture, it didn't succeed entirely, and Putin's has reawakened many of these forces of history, maybe positive, maybe negative, trying to give a sense of Russian identity, and we're seeing those emerge, and suddenly it's like history asserting itself with these great strength in a way that I think as Americans sometimes it's a bit shocking. Does he really care about history like that? Is that really that important? But it is. You know, it can be, and that blood and soil nationalism or tribalism that sometimes goes along with that is a dangerous force. I mean, it's like, I feel sometimes, you know, we all come from a place and tradition and family, and that's important. And that's all part of who we are. And I get in our globalized world, sometimes asserting that truth of place and where we're from and all of that is critical. It's like, can we appreciate the positives of that without like resorting to these tremendous negatives that come with getting lost in that? And it feels like we're seeing an example maybe of we'll see. I mean, but potentially of getting caught in the gravity of that history. You know?
Well, I think, you know, what's happening in many ways is identity crisis. And I guess that is...
That's when you really reach for history more strongly, right?
Well, generally, because it's like the rootedness in something. I mean, cynically or not, the idea that Russia is supposed to be a more traditional, you know, culture. So traditional gender roles, traditional social roles, a strong church, unlike the West, where everything is negotiable. Isn't history. I mean, it is a remarkable irony, once again, that there's so much information available on the net, but more and more people have a very, you know, very weak grasp of history. I mean, it's not quite the same thing, but I was looking at a recorded lecture I gave a couple of years ago, and I just noticed it had quite a few, you know, views. So I hadn't looked at it in a while, but it was. Long story short, I made a remark in the lecture about Buddha and his essential messages. You know, life is suffering, and how do we avoid suffering? And it wasn't a lecture about Buddhism; it was just like a remark in the context of it. There were so many comments. The Buddha never said life is suffering. Life is insane.
You're kidding.
No. And I looked and I thought,
you're kidding.
No. And what I did was I went to everyone and I said, I wrote.
That's the fundamental truth.
I know. I said, first thing I wrote was like, Four Noble Truths, anyone? You know, then it was like, dukkha translates as suffering. You know, it's the first noble truth. And then I went back today and I looked and people said, show me a reference for that.
Oh my God.
And I said, get any simple Buddhism for Dummies book, basically. But it just was like, no, I don't know. I'm no, you know, master of Buddhism.
Buddha has been fully brought into the postmodern progressive.
Well, it's like, are you getting it from the latest book on mindfulness you read?
Where's that coming from?
So I just thought nobody, and again, but this, it's this whole, in a way, it is like the end of history. And this is one of the end of history in that sense where it's all jumbled up. It's all available. But the whole notion of it kind of, you know, having a sequence and cause and effect and connection is sort of, it's the simultaneity of history, the availability of it rather than the real sense of it. And
that's like, it reminds me of like Gebser, everything,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing too. I mean,
of postmodern history.
Yeah. Again, and again, we initially think, oh, that sounds good. Well, yeah, yes and no. You know, you know, but the other side of it was that, talk about the end of history, well, there was that book by Francis Fukuyama in the 90s called The End of History.
Sure. Yeah.
And this is something that has triggered a great deal of rancor and rage from people like Dugin his readers, is that, well, the end of history for Francis Fukuyama is the spread of free market capitalism and all that. And because Hegel said, you know, the history is moving towards the greatest expression and embodiment of freedom. And according to Fukuyama, well, that sort of happened, hasn't it? You know, the Western liberalism is more or less conquered. And this was Dugin's thing, is like, you know, we live in a unipolar world now, which you can't have. You have to have two to have a pole. Sorry, you can't have one pole. There's no one end of a stick. So any case, but he's a master at these kind of coinages that at first are striking, but when you think about them, it's like, oh, really? But any case, the whole idea is that Western liberalism it's not a political view. It's not a view of society. It's become the only one that we can possibly embrace. You know, this is the only, we finally arrived at the, you know, one surefire political view of things, and hence his sort of velcroing together of the good bits of, you know, of National Socialism and fascism and all this as some kind of fourth political theory, he calls it, to stand up against that. But it's just, in a way we are in that same position in the dirty 30s where there was a battle between fascism and communism, and the democracy didn't really have anywhere in there, or whatever you want to call it, you know. And another thing that happens, and this is the same phenomena with QAnon. I don't know if that's still a thing anymore, but I mean,
I think it is. I mean, it's still there.
It's come up in interviews and people, and I said, well, QAnon strikes me as a place where the far right and the far out meet. Yeah. So this is the thing. It's like, you know, talk about all the spiritual stuff you quoted me.
Well, I have friends on the left who are spiritually, who have strong spiritual convictions, who have embraced things like QAnon and like Russia Today, RT, because they're like postmodern critiques of modernism that are sort of that Putin, you know, that Russia kind of wants to empower, because the enemy of my enemy is my friend, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, because anything that undermines modernism and materialism is inherently good. Therefore all this is good, even though what you're really doing is sort of empowering this more traditional view of the world often. Anyway, it's fascinating how that works.
Well, it's, you know, I said the enemy of my enemy is my friend until your first enemy is neutralized, and then
exactly, and then I go after you.
And exactly. Yeah, well, that's, you know, and you're, you know, so no, it's but I know it's a difficult, you know, it's the razor's edge. It's a difficult tightrope to walk, that's why I do my best to try. And it's not the both sides kind of thing, but I've fallen into being a historian. I don't claim to be an academic historian. I certainly don't have a degree in it or anything like that. But to write histories or stories, told a story of either people in biographies or these ideas or, you know, times, particular decades. Like I did a book about the 60s and all that. And you just, as I say, I try to give as balance, just to say, here's what's happening. And I think you can tell by my tone that, you know, when I don't agree with something or not, you know, in no way, how should I say it? I'm as aware of the inequities and you know, drawbacks and of capitalism and the Western system and materialism and all of that. Believe me. At the same time, as I said, you know, as you both said, you really have to be careful who you want in your posse, you know, against those guys, because you have to check out what are they really offering. And I certainly don't want some traditional caste-like society or anything like that. But I'm, at the same time, I do think we live in the strange times.
I always think of go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say strange times when suddenly everything is fluid, you know, you know, your sexuality, your gender, everything. And some people think, wow, that's wonderful. It's some fantastic. And others think, like, hold on a second. You know, everything is just dissolving. That's what it is now. It's the Heraclitean change has really accelerated. And so I can understand people wanting to hold on to something that's stable, whatever that might be, you know?
Yeah. It's tricky. Yeah. I can too. And sometimes we need to affirm some of the positive values of even earlier eras without succumbing to the negatives. You know, it's like, but I can think, you know, it's easy to think, oh, this modern society, you know, wouldn't it be better? We can imagine, I can imagine utopias that would be so much better, you know, so many of us seem to be able to be, but it's like, they don't always end up better, you know, and I think we have to be very careful about what we imagine. I think of that great Nietzschean statement where he said, You know, what were we thinking when we unchained this earth from the sun? Mm-hmm. And it's like, we have to be careful about unchaining big things, you know? Well, it's like, we have to, it's also important.
You said, you know, when you look into the abyss, remember the abyss looks into you as well.
Yeah, right.
And, and beware when you're fighting monsters that you don't become a monster yourself. So,
yeah.
I mean, Nietzsche's, you know, fantastic, and he's so quotable, and he's often quoted even against himself because people think they know what he's saying, but no,
I'm sure I just did that.
He's much more clever. He's much more clever than you are. I mean, that's sort of the thing. A lot of people don't get the, it's not humorous, but Nietzsche is very, very sharp. And oftentimes is what he doesn't say. That's what's, you know, in any case, but again, you know, you have to. One of the things people I allude to in different books is the historian. And actually, I wrote an article about this, I think, for What is Enlightenment or Enlightenment.
Yeah.
Arnold Toynbee, the 20th century historian who wrote this fantastic work, A Study of History. And it's one of those books, if you ever are going to the deserted island, you should definitely take A Study of History, because it's about 20 volumes, and it'll keep you going for a while. But he said there, when a civilization faces what he calls the time of troubles, and that phrase comes from Russian history. And this,
oh, wow.
this is after the collapse of Ivan's empire. And Boris Godunov, who there's an opera written about him, was briefly in power, but he dies young, and then there's a collapse again, and there's a scramble for who's going to get power, and this is the beginning of the Romanovs. But in any case, Toynbee takes that phrase, and he says, whenever civilization faces its time of troubles, there are two stereotypical responses, and one is the archaist, where it's an attempt to return to an earlier time, a golden age. And the other is the futurist, where you try to sort of, you know, shoot off into some, you know, infinitely better future. And today, you know, we have both of those, you know, in a variety of different ways, you know, the archaic revival of, you know, people like Terence McKenna were talking about how we have to get back to Wilbur, I guess we call that the pre-trans fallacy kind of thing, or the transhumanists now.
Yeah. Right.
Who let's forget about being human. Let's all download into, you know, computers and be like cyborgs and stuff like that. And a lot of the ideology and philosophy of this group of thinkers known as the cosmists in Russia, there's a great revival of them today. And they're actually intellectual scientific heroes. There's universities, there's big monuments and things of that sort. A lot of their ideas feed into transhumanism.
They're kind of similar.
Yeah. Because one of the central things is this remarkable fellow named Fedorov, who was a librarian in Moscow. But he had this... What strikes us immediately is this really, you know, strange idée fixe, but it was that the one common task that would unite the entire planet was the revival of the dead.
Mm.
He didn't know how it would happen, but he knew it had to happen. And there you go. And once we figured out how to do it, it wouldn't just be whoever just recently died on the operating table. It would be all the dead. So everybody in the morgue, everybody buried.
Oh my God!
Believe me, but it would be the resurrection of the flesh made real through tech, through technology. And he's talking about this in the late 19th century. Dostoevsky was impressed with his work. Tolstoy sat at his feet. The philosopher Soloviev was, you know, a devotee. But this idea is actually behind the Russian space program. I'll get to that, because Fedorov said that we have to collect all the, what he called the ancestral dust. So the dust of all, going back to the very first dead person, Adam and Eve, you know, very them. But somehow, I don't know how he figured out the dust that got out of the Earth's gravitational field, but somehow the ancestral dust has got out into space. So we have to be able to get out into space to collect all the ancestral dust. But there's another reason we have to go out into space, because we have to find inhabitable planets, because the Earth won't be big enough to house all the dead people once we bring them back. There wouldn't be any room.
That's probably true.
There wouldn't be any room for them. And so, again, one of the people who sat at his, feet, Fedor's feet, was a fellow named Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who actually later on did the actual rocket science.
Wow.
He did the real rocket science to figure out, okay, how would we get out there? And he did the science. And then today, they said there's universities, there's institutes named after him, coins and medals and that kind of thing. And Sputnik went up in 57 because of that history going back there.
Wow. That's an amazing, amazing current of history. It's amazing. I was just literally 2 weeks ago, I was at NASA with a former astronaut, and you could feel, and it was amazing. Cause you know, one of the things you forget, it's like, you know, Russian culture has contributed so much to the world and Russian science too. And one of the areas that they've been very good science is in, like you say, in aerospace.
Yeah.
And you could feel at NASA, you could feel the concern, you know, they've been building these relationships with Russian cosmonauts for decades.
Oh, right.
And suddenly we don't quite know how that's all going to play out, you know, and you could really feel that. But I love that history. And I just think, you know, one of the things you do well is you know, and so in many of our contemporary intellectual, in the academic world, the esoteric parts of history are sort of kind of scrubbed out, but they're influential. They're not the only history, but they're influential. It's important to understand them. One of the things I appreciate what you do is you take a subject like this and you bring back a lot of the esoteric currents that were actually influential. And even people who were very well known and very famous and very powerful in terms of our history. So it's good to understand it. It's good that we don't scrub that out of our history because it was influential and we need to understand it. We need to appreciate it. So I appreciate you doing that work, you know?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I say in Return of Holy Russia towards the end of the book, that one of the ideas or dreams in the sense of vision of this new cultural epic was that it would bring together sort of the technology or the science of the West with this kind of mystical, more intuitive vision of the East. Or, you know, and Russia was supposed to be the way of bringing
the connector
together, because it itself was a nation that was fused, had these two elements fused in itself. And there's a whole wonderful thing. I mean, there's so much of what we consider today to be like central ideas about ecology and conservation and saving the planet and all of that. I mean, there was a whole kind of there's a fellow named Sergei Bulgakov, who nobody knows about now, and he was one of these Silver Age thinkers, and he was on one of the philosophy steamers. But he had developed this whole what he called Sophionic economy, the feminine aspect of the divine, which means wisdom, you know, philosophia is the love of wisdom. There's a whole Sophionic strain and tradition in Russian philosophy as well. Soloviev himself had several visions of Sophia at different times and that kind of thing. But there's a whole notion of against sort of the, how should we say it, the industrialism that was kicked in with the Soviet Union, especially Stalin and, you know, the 5-year plan and all that, which was, you know, talk about rapacious, use of natural resources. Russia's parts of Russia are still suffering from environmental, problems from that. But this other notion of a Sophionic economy was something radically different. It was the whole idea of the Earth as a living planet and, having to, keep things sort of in a balance. And I can't go into the details, but it was very, very radically different. And it's the kind of thing that today we're thinking, oh, this is new kind of thing. So, I mean, the sad thing is that you have wonderful ideas coming out of a culture and a nation that, for a variety of different reasons, we in the West are suspicious about. And then if they get associated with war and war crimes and atrocities, even vaguely, just in the sense, just in the taint of being, Russian. I mean, I forget where I saw it, but some university, I think in Italy, stopped, they took Dostoevsky off the shelf or something.
I know. It's like, come on, people.
Jesus.
I think I wrote a tweet about that. I said, like, I don't know where the line is, but I know that's way over it. You know?
It's understood, but that's not going to help, you know,
exactly.
In the first place. That's one reason why I wrote the book. I said, yes, by all means, let us be suspicious of the uses to which Putin is putting these ideas, but let's not, you know, throw them out. Let's take a look at them, because they still could be of use to us today, regardless of what use he is making of them.
Right. Well, that's great. Well, I appreciate you coming on the podcast. And the book is The Return of Holy Russia. And what an interesting, what a unique, you're just not going to find, this kind of, capturing of esoteric and history with the also just the straight history of Russia.
Well, that's the same. I didn't start out to write a book, a history of Russia, but I got so fascinated with it doing the research that I kept going, no, I got to put that in. No, I got to put that in. So I said, well, let's just
start. I was surprised as I was reading. I was like, wow, he really went deep in.
Let's start from the beginning. That's when I just do it. So that's, it's one of the perks of doing this, sort of work, as it were, is that now I know, a fairly decent amount of Russian history.
And just so the readers who are interested in your work know, you have a new book coming out not too long. What's that?
A new book has come out earlier this year about something completely different called Dreaming Ahead of Time, and it's about my experiences with precognitive dreams and synchronicities and coincidence. And this goes back. I've been recording.
Do you know Eric Wargo's work?
I've read Time Loops, and we exchanged a couple of tweets. It's all. I mean, he tried to give a scientific explanation or account for it. And I'm not. I don't do that. It's more from
you're resisting that.
Well, it's more from phenomenon. I have no idea how these things happen. I know they happen. It doesn't matter to me to if we can explain it scientifically. In fact, I'm not particularly interested in that because I at this point I tend to think it's something else. evidence of something else.
Well, I want to get you on the podcast, another show talking about that.
Yeah, let's do that. Great. Okay. Yeah. My pleasure.
All right. Well, thanks, Gary. Take care and
all right.
Appreciate
take
you coming.
Care, and let me know when if this is up, and I'll tweet it up.
All right, I will.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
I want to thank Gary Lachman for joining me today on the podcast. And once again, the book is called The Return of Holy Russia, Apocalyptic History, Mystical Awakening, and the Struggle for the Soul of the World. All right, I think that's about it for today's episode. A reminder that if you want to follow this podcast more closely, you can always sign up for my newsletter, which is also called Thinking Ahead, and you can sign up for that at carterphipps.com/thinkingahead. That's it, and look forward to next time.